Tune Review Print Speaking to the Blind, celebrating 40 years of audio newspaper production. Welcome to this week's edition of the National Podcast, recorded at the Bishop Briggs Media Centre by our amazing volunteers. You can get in touch with us via Facebook, Twitter or Instagram using @TuneReview, that is @CUEANDREVIEW. You can also contact us directly by emailing information@tunereview.com. That is information@CUEANDREVIEW.com or by calling 0141 772 3976. That's 0141 772 3976.
This is from The National on Friday the 27th of October 2023, from the news section. Crispin Blunt's statement in full after arrest on suspicion of rape. This article is written by Gregor Young. Conservative MP Crispin Blunt has been arrested on suspicion of rape and the possession of controlled substances. The former minister, 63, identified himself as the man that Surrey police detained in Hawley on Wednesday morning, before his release on conditional bail. The MP for Reigate said he will cooperate fully with the ongoing investigation and is confident that he will not be charged. He said that he has been interviewed twice over the incident, the first time 3 weeks ago when he initially reported my concern over extortion. Blunt has now had the Tory whip suspended and has been asked to stay away from Parliament after being arrested on suspicion of rape, it has been reported. Crispin Blunt's statement in full. It has been reported that an MP was arrested yesterday in connection with an allegation of rape. I am confirming that MP was me. The fact of the arrest requires a formal notification of the Speaker and then my chief whip. I have now been interviewed twice in connection with this incident, the first time 3 weeks ago when I initially reported my concern over extortion. The second time was earlier this morning under caution following arrest. The arrest was unnecessary as I remained ready to cooperate fully with the investigation that I am confident will end without charge. I do not intend to say anything further on this matter until the police have completed their inquiries. That article was written by Gregor Young. This is from The National on Friday the 27th of October 2023, from the Politics section. Elon Musk calls Humza Yousaf a racist in Twitter attack. This article is written by Lucy Garcia. Elon Musk has accused Scotland's First Minister of being a racist after watching a viral video of Humza Yousaf discussing racial injustice. Musk, whose ownership of Twitter, X, has been mired in controversy over disinformation and platforming of hate speech, attacked Yousaf on social media on Friday night. The world's richest man was responding to a video posted by an account called End Wokeness, which alleged Yousaf openly despises white people. Why would Scotland's Parliament and King select a guy who hates almost 100% of the country? The Post read, attaching a short 45-second clip of Yousaf addressing MSPs in 2020. The clip has been shared widely over the years as alt-right figures suggest it shows the SNP leader expressing anger over the number of white people in Scotland. In the video, Yousaf says, "Most senior positions in Scotland are filled almost exclusively by people who are white," listing examples like the Lord Justice Clerk, Solicitor General, and other senior figures in political and civic life. The full speech, which is nearly 10 minutes long, was delivered during a debate on racial injustice in Scotland, sparked by global protests over racism following George Floyd's murder at the hands of the police officer Derek Chauvin. Earlier this year, a Reuters fact check found that the shortened version of the video was missing context. On Friday night, Musk responded to the clip, which had been viewed by more than 6 million times, writing, "What a blatant racist." High-profile unionist accounts celebrated the intervention, with some calling on Musk to ban Youssef from Twitter, X altogether. Supporters of Youssef stepped in too, with Mikey Stewart writing, "Your reaction is completely wrong. You've been baited by a racist." The hatred towards Humza for being brown is astonishing. Sort your S**** 3 times out. Freedom of speech is one thing, but you're spreading a lie. Musk's accusations come after Youssef was featured on the cover of Time magazine earlier this month as part of a special on 10 trailblazers shaping the future. He was highlighted as the first non-white and youngest ever first minister, as well as the first Muslim politician to lead a Western democracy. I hope it also inspires others, particularly when multiculturalism is portrayed by some as a weakness, Youssef said in the interview. In Scotland, I am proud we are a welcoming nation, and our diversity is seen as one of our greatest strengths. Youssef has also spoken on the impact of being targeted by the right on social media, including by US-based far-right figures. Being the recipient of online abuse has become a regular feature of my life in public service, he told the Scotsman this summer. That doesn't mean we shouldn't simply accept it. It is important that we do everything we can to stamp it out. He added, I know that the overwhelming majority of people in Scotland want to live in a country where all minority groups are not just protected, but accepted for who they are. And, as First Minister, I'm determined to use the office to help build a country where all of our citizens live a life free from hatred. That article was written by Lucy Garcia. This is from The National on Friday, the 27th of October, 2023, from the news section. Firefighters' union protests outside Scottish Parliament over cuts. This article is written by Lucy Jackson. Firefighters have staged a rally outside the Scottish Parliament, demanding the government takes urgent action to end a decade of cuts they say have left the service facing disaster. The Fire Brigades Union, FBU, said members will be left with no choice but to consider all options if ministers ignore the multiple crises facing the service. Firefighters gathered outside Holyrood in Edinburgh on Thursday to call on the Scottish Government to reverse its 5-year flat cash budget allocation. FBU Scotland Chairman Gus Sproul said the union had been making its case to the Scottish Government and was being ignored. Sproul said that more than 1,200 jobs had been cut since the Scottish Fire and Rescue Service, SFRS, came into existence just over a decade ago. He added that the FBU in Scotland predicted that another 780 jobs could be cut if no changes were made to budgets, cuts that the union says would endanger the lives of firefighters and the communities they serve. Only this year we saw 10 fire appliances, 9 high-reach vehicles, and the permanently crewed river rescue boat on the Clyde withdrawn from stations, leaving communities with reduced emergency cover, Sproul added. The Scottish Government responded that it had provided SFRS with £368 million this year, an increase of £14.4 million on 2022 to 2023. A government spokesperson added that Scotland has a higher number of firefighters per head of population than other parts of the UK. SFRS Chief Officer Ross Haggart said, "In terms of the future of the service, we have been clear that we must modernise to ensure we are best placed to meet the changing risk and demand we face across Scotland, while addressing also our ongoing financial challenges. This is undoubtedly a challenging time for the public sector in Scotland, and we are not immune to this. we've been clear that difficult decisions will have to be made without investment. However, any permanent changes now or in the future will only be made following full engagement and consultation with all our stakeholders, including the FBU. Haggart added that the safety of Scotland's communities and firefighters will always be of paramount importance to the Scottish Fire and Rescue Service. The rally comes after the firestorm report, published by the FBU earlier this week, found Scotland's fire service to be in crisis with low morale, underinvestment and budget cuts impacting severely on the firefighters' ability to respond effectively to serious and life-threatening incidents. Speaking at the rally, Sproul said, "This show of strength by our members and the explosive firestorm report we published earlier this week means we cannot be ignored any longer. If the Scottish Government continues to ignore the multiple crises facing the service, our members will be left with no option but to consider all options to force political leaders to wake up to the disaster that is befalling what should be a well-trained, well-equipped and well-resourced public service." A Scottish Government spokesperson said, "Firefighters play a vital role in protecting our communities and the Scottish Fire and Rescue Service has continued to deliver the high standard of services required to keep Scotland safe. That is why, despite difficult financial circumstances due to UK government austerity, we are providing SFRS with more than £368 million this year, an increase of £14.4 million on 2022 to 2023. While the allocation of resources, along with the recruitment and retention of firefighters, is an operational matter for SFRS, we are maintaining frontline services with a higher number of firefighters in Scotland than other parts of the UK. Ministers will continue engaging with the FBU to discuss their concerns." That article was written by Lucy Jackson. This is from The National on Friday the 27th of October 2023, from the news section. Plans for hydrogen pipeline from Scotland to Germany accelerated. This article is written by James Walker. The Scottish Government is accelerating plans for a hydrogen pipeline connecting Scotland to Germany. Energy Minister Gillian Martin announced on Thursday that the Net Zero Technology Centre, NZTC, has been awarded £200,000 to look into the feasibility and economic opportunity of exporting green hydrogen from Scotland to Germany and solidify the case for infrastructure investment. The MSP for Aberdeenshire East told The National that it represented a great opportunity for Scotland, with the proposed pipeline key to unlocking an already burgeoning market for Scottish hydrogen in Europe. Martin said, "It's a huge opportunity for companies in Scotland looking to diversify into hydrogen production and those already working to produce hydrogen." She added, "It's not just Germany, who are obviously moving very fast. We've got interest in Scottish hydrogen from Belgium, from the Netherlands, from Spain, which isn't an energy-producing nation." Green hydrogen refers to gas made by using electricity generated from renewable sources to split water into its two constituents elements, oxygen and hydrogen. When burned, hydrogen does not give off carbon dioxide, and the oxygen byproduct has no negative impacts on the atmosphere. While some critics say it is not very efficient, there is optimism due to the fact that hydrogen could replace natural gas and use much of the existing infrastructure. The research by NZTC will analyse and integrate work already undertaken by the not-for-profit, as well as several notable European projects currently underway. An example of this includes NZTC's Hydrogen Backbone Link, which in a report in August proposed an undersea network of pipelines that that would connect Scotland with Ireland and either the Netherlands and or Germany, making use of existing North Sea infrastructure for natural gas. They estimated it would cost around £2.8 billion to deliver it, routed from Scotland to Germany, avoiding England. In the years between 2030 and 2050, the report also noted that Scotland could meet up to 10.5% of Europe's low-carbon hydrogen import needs. This is infrastructure that is going to be generating a great deal of revenue. We've got potential in Scotland to be producing 25 gigawatts of hydrogen by 2045. And that's huge, Martin said, adding that it could also lead to Scotland providing the infrastructure for other hydrogen-producing nations in the North Atlantic. Ireland, for example, has got hydrogen production aspirations, so providing a route not only for hydrogen produced in Scotland, but Ireland as well, we'd be providing a bridge for Irish export. It's something that we've already been talking about during my visit to Ireland in the summer. Scottish Government's Hydrogen Action Plan estimates that the development of a hydrogen economy in Scotland could create between 70,000 to over 300,000 jobs, with potential gross value added, GVA, impacts between £5 billion and £25 billion a year by 2045, depending on the scale of production and the extent of exports. Martin stressed, however, that any project needs to be balanced. She said, "We need to balance that export potential with what we can actually be doing domestically, because we could be decarbonising quite a lot of our industrial processes with our own domestic hydrogen." Martin Tulloch, Director of Energy Transition at NZTC, said that analysis from International Energy Agency shows that Scotland has vast potential for green hydrogen production from offshore wind. He added, "At the same time, it's widely recognised that Germany will have the greatest demand for low-carbon hydrogen as Europe moves towards net zero. This funding marks a significant step forward in strengthening cross-border ties and will position Scotland and Germany at the heart of an integrated North Sea pipeline system." That article was written by James Walker. This is from The National on Friday the 27th of October 2023, from the Culture section. Scottish Album of the Year Award 2023 winner announced. This article is written by Lucy Jackson. The winner of the Scottish Album of the Year SAY Award was announced tonight at a prestigious ceremony in Stirling. Edinburgh-based Young Fathers picked up the award and a £20,000 cash prize for their album Heavy Heavy. Legendary Scottish artist Paolo Nutini's debut record, These Streets, was awarded the Modern Scottish Classic Award, with the Paisley singer-songwriter's manager and sister accepting the award on Nutini's behalf, as he is currently out of the country. Young Fathers are the first act to win the SAY award for the third time, previously winning in 2014 with Tape 2 and 2018 with Coco Sugar. Songwriting duo No Windows, based in Edinburgh, was named The Sound of Young Scotland, winning a £10,000 funding package to create their debut album. The package includes cash grants, use of the old toll booth's recording studio in Stirling, business advice sessions, and up to 500 vinyl pressings from Seabass Vinyl, Scotland's first vinyl pressing plant. The awards organisers say they have distributed more than £350,000 in prize money since its inception in 2012. Robert Kilpatrick, interim CEO and creative director of the Scottish Music Industry Association, SMIA, hailed Young Fathers' third album as their strongest and most mesmerising body of work to date. Kilpatrick said, "In 2018, Young Fathers made history by becoming the first artist to win the Scottish Album of the Year award twice. As the band continued on a meteoric rise, defying definitions with their sound and bringing a level of energy and power that's uniquely theirs, tonight sees them claim Scotland's National Music Prize for the third time, with their strongest and most mesmerising body of work to date. Their win signifies the importance of recognising and investing in outstanding Scottish talent, and through the support of the SAY Award and many other well-deserved accolades, young fathers continue to capture the magic and bring it into the lives of music fans worldwide. Tonight's win further cements their world-class status, and through doing so, Scotland's global reputation as a country overflowing with outstanding and idiosyncratic creative talent. They're a band we can be proud of, a band we can be inspired by, and a band who, quite simply, keep astounding, delighting and enthralling us. The awards ceremony took place at the Albert Halls in Stirling and was hosted by Nicola Magan and Vic Galloway. The nine runners-up each received £1,000 in addition to concrete totems made by local Stirling artist Brutal Concrete Workshop. The winners took home concrete and terrazzo bowls, also made by Brutal Concrete Workshop, created using low-carbon concrete and designed to last. The SAY Award shortlist for 2023 in alphabetical order was Andrew Wozelik, Hearing the Water Before Seeing the Falls, Becky Sikaza, 12 Wooden Boxes, Burns, Nova's Dad, Breacha Heimbol, Carry Them With Us, Brooke Coombe, Black as the New Gold, Cloth, Secret Measure, Hamish Hawk, Angel Numbers, Joseph, Permanent Damage, Paolo Nutini, Last Night in the Bittersweet, Young Fathers, Heavy Heavy. That article was written by Lucy Jackson. This is from The National, on Friday the 27th of October 2023, from the comments section. We owe Humza Yousaf gratitude for his stance on Palestine. This article is written by Owen Jones. We are living through a crime of historic proportions. The horror of Gaza will scream through the ages. History can be a savage judge, but we don't need to await its verdict so far as our leading politicians are concerned. They have lined up behind Israel's murderous assault, even as thousands, many children, have perished under missile bombardment, and an illegal collective punishment has been imposed with the suffocation of access to water, fuel, food, and other necessities. Even as Israeli leaders and officials promise to eliminate everything, reduce Gaza to a city of tents, with an emphasis on damage, not accuracy, and the United Nations warns of ethnic cleansing, crimes against humanity, and even the threat of genocide, politicians have not blinked in their uncritical defence of this onslaught. Well, not all politicians. I've long admired Scottish First Minister Humza Yousaf, even though I don't hail from the Scottish nationalist tradition. We're of the same generation. He's 8 months younger, and lived through similar political upheavals which shaped our worldviews, even if we didn't arrive at all the same conclusions. Given how endemic and respectable Islamophobia is in our societies, his elevation to the top of Scottish politics was a moving historical moment. Like all Muslims in the public eye, he has faced relentless racist hounding, but he has never deviated from his attachment to an inclusive, civic nationalism. And, unlike his opponent in the SNP leadership election, Yousaf offered a passionate defence of LGBT+ rights. His message was clear. All minorities with an experience of oppression and prejudice should stand together or fall divided. An international crisis of this magnitude would present a profound challenge to any leader. Yet, in the case of Yusuf, this crisis isn't simply a calamity which, however grave, has consumed the lives of others. The partner of Scottish-Palestinian psychotherapist Nadia El Nakla, who so poignantly spoke at the SNP's conference, Yusuf's in-laws are trapped in Gaza as thousands of tons of explosives are dropped by a military superpower on a densely populated strip of land no bigger than Greater Glasgow. His brother-in-law there is a doctor who refuses to leave his post, risking his life to save others as an already devastated health service collapses under bombardment and lack of electricity, water and medicine. Their cousins have suffered shrapnel injuries. Their family is running out of water. His mother-in-law has lost hope. Every moment must be burdened with fear about their loved one's welfare. It is difficult to imagine a greater emotional exhaustion. Many would be overwhelmed by anxiety. You would easily be forgiven for taking a leave of absence from work in such circumstances. Instead, Yusuf has continued to fulfil his leadership duties, as well as passionately championing the independence cause he is clearly so committed to, all while navigating an appalling international crisis which consumes his own family. That included offering comfort for the mother of Bernard Cowan, a Scotsman murdered in the massacre perpetrated by Hamas on the 7th of October. Standing in a synagogue, declaring, "Your grief is my grief," he presented a model of unity in the face of horror. In that context, his unequivocal defence of humanity is all the more compelling. He was swift to condemn a policy of collective punishment. This is quite the contrast. We might expect a hard-right Tory government to unapologetically stand by Benjamin Netanyahu's vicious inhumanity. But Keir Starmer has revived the New Labour tradition which brought us the blood and chaos of the Iraq War, despite promising to put human rights at the heart of foreign policy in his leadership campaign. He has defended Israel's right to cut off water and energy, then shamelessly lied about doing so. Labour councillors have resigned in disgust, but despite overwhelming support for an immediate ceasefire, according to YouGov, just 3% express total opposition, Starmer cannot bring himself to call for the violence to end. Real leadership has instead come from Yusuf, who has called on all parties to commit to a ceasefire for the sake of those innocent children who are suffering so badly, asking, quite rightly, how many more children have to die? The First Minister is right to condemn both main parties for their infuriating stance. In the West, Scotland joins only Spain and Ireland so far in calling for a ceasefire. It may, for now, be a lonely demand, but it will be vindicated by history, just as those complicit in this bloodbath will be damned. There is something else which must be remarked upon. This brutal episode has proved a nauseating spectacle of overt racism. There isn't even the pretense amongst most media outlets and politicians that a Palestinian civilian life has an equal worth to that of an Israeli or Western civilian life. But they do. Yet 4 million Muslims across the United Kingdom are being told that most of their establishment does not care for innocent civilians unless they are white. That, alongside Labour's London Mayor Sadiq Khan, we have a prominent Muslim politician affirming the universal worth of all humanity is a desperately needed counter. This is a bleak moment for those trapped in the killing fields in Gaza, Yusuf's loved ones amongst them. We must fear the darkest days yet to come. But amidst all the evil and horror, Yusuf has proven a beacon of humanity, and wherever we might live, we owe him an endless gratitude. That article was written by Owen Jones.
This is from The National on Monday, 30th October 2023. From the News section. UK weather. Heavy rain expected ahead of Storm Ciarán. By James Walker. The UK is braced for another deluge of rain over the next few days, as wet and windy weather is expected to build up to a nasty storm later in the week. The Environment Agency has issued more than 70 flood warnings ahead of the UK being hit by Storm Ciarán on Wednesday, while yellow weather warnings for rain have been issued by the Met Office from Monday until Thursday. Gusts of 80 miles an hour are possible along the south coast of England, with 20 to 25 millimetres of rain expected across southern and western areas, but potentially up to 40 to 60 millimetres over higher ground, the Met Office said. On Monday, the worst of the weather is likely to hit the south coast of England, much of Wales and parts of Northern Ireland. The forecaster advises the latest rains could lead to disruption on roads and public transport, while already flood-affected areas following Storm Babet could get worse. Flooding was seen across Sussex during the weekend, including the Priory Meadow shopping centre in Hastings, which was evacuated on Saturday with people posting on social media showing deep flood water coming through the entrance. On Sunday, a caravan park in Bognor Regis was also underwater, with the town's Tesco supermarket car park flooded, while a house had its roof ripped off in heavy winds that residents described as like a tornado. Marco Petagna, a Met Office meteorologist, said, "We've had various warnings in force across the UK over the last few days, and there's plenty more issued for the next couple of days. The main focus in the next day or two is towards the east of Scotland and north-east England, where there is a yellow rain warning until 3 a.m. There will be persistent rain up there, and then the focus for heavy showers will be across parts of southern and southeastern England and South Wales, as well as parts of Northern Ireland, with some heavy and sudden showers as well." He said that Tuesday was expected to still be unsettled, but quieter, before heavy winds and longer spells of rain develop on Wednesday night into Thursday as Storm Ciarán arrives. He said, "There are possible gusts of 80 to 90 miles an hour in some exposed southern areas. It's probably quite a nasty storm, this one." Kate Marks, flood deputy manager at the Environment Agency, said, "We urge people to stay safe on the coast and to remember to take extreme care on coastal paths and promenades. Flooding on low-lying coastal roads is also possible, and people must avoid driving through floodwater, as just 30 centimetres of flowing water is enough to move your car. The weather is expected to worsen as the week progresses, with rain warnings in place until Wednesday and a deep area of low pressure set to arrive on Thursday, which has been named by the Met Office as Storm Ciarán, which will bring strong winds and heavy rain to southern parts of England and Wales." Met Office Deputy Chief Meteorologist Chris Amond said, "Winds associated with Storm Ciarán are likely to gust up to 80 miles an hour along the south coast of England, with a small risk of somewhere exposed seeing 90 miles an hour, and winds could even gust up to 50 or 60 miles an hour further inland. This deep, low-pressure system will also bring heavy rain to much of the UK, but the heaviest rain is expected in southern and western areas, with 20 to 25 millimetres quite widely across the region, but up to 40 to 60 millimetres potentially over higher ground. Heavy and persistent rain will fall on already saturated ground, bringing a risk of further impacts, such as flooding in areas that are already struggling to clean up from the heavy rainfall we've seen over the last week or so." That article was by James Walker. This is from The National, on Monday, 30th October 2023, from the Politics section. ScotRail's return to public hands doesn't give us a real say. By Professor Gregor Gall. The bill to privatise the railways in Britain was put in the statute book in Parliament 30 years ago, come November 5th. For the travelling public, it was definitely a case of remember the 5th of November, because it has led to decades of untold misery and despair. Forget the apocryphal stories of British rail sandwiches inedibly curling up at the edges. Such stories were used as cover to say public ownership does not work and to promote privatisation. Rather, remember that from 1979 onwards, British Rail was deliberately run down by the Thatcherite Tories in order to reinforce the case that privatisation would make the rail network better. Admittedly, that task was not too hard, as British Rail had already been starved of much necessary investment by previous Labour and Tory governments. Of course, privatisation did not bring about the boon of a new age of rail that was trumpeted. Customers did not come first as the result of competition for them by capitalist companies. Strikes, delays, cancellations, bus replacement services, rising fares and tired old rolling stock and more laterally crap Wi-Fi are just the most obvious signs of this. Underneath this are the capitalist culprits of profiteering companies reliant upon continuing public subsidy. Currently, four franchises south of the border are effectively nationalised as the government had to step in as the operator of last resort. The same is true of ScotRail and the Caledonian Sleeper in Scotland and in Wales with its franchise. The quality and quantity of service provision became so bad that governments in London, Edinburgh and Cardiff were forced to act. Should Labour form a majority Westminster government after the forthcoming general election, they have pledged to return the remaining services to the public sector. But there is a danger that lies ahead in returning rail to public ownership. This is because there are different models of public ownership. The one we had under British Rail was that of civil servant mandarins and government-appointed chairs from well-heeled backgrounds running the rail network, supposedly on our behalf. Its modern version is of the public sector recruiting from the private sector for its top management. Take ScotRail as an example of what is to come, because one of the common features of the SNP and Labour is their belief in managerialism. ScotRail is run by a management team of eight executives with salaries ranging from £115,000 to £330,000 a year. ScotRail is in turn managed by Scottish Rail Holdings and its paid board directors earn between £85,000 to £108,000 per year for less than a five-day working week. On this board, there are two non-executive directors, one of whom is Scottish Trades Union Congress's General Secretary, Ros Foyer. This is hardly evidence of industrial democracy with a worker director on the board. Foyer is only there to give Scottish Rail Holdings advice and has no power of veto. What would be evidence of industrial democracy would be at least one representative of the unions representing the workforce on the ScotRail board. Even better would be one of these representatives being seconded from being a ScotRail employee. And then, of course, there's no representation for the travelling public at this senior level. Since returning to the public sector on April 1st, 2022, ScotRail has not exactly covered itself in glory. What we need is a participative and democratic form of public ownership north and south of the border for our railways. Otherwise, we will continue to have a conventional form management administering the network on our behalf, telling us they know what is best for us with their high executive salaries. If we had this participative and democratic form of public ownership, we could begin to envisage another kind of railway. This would be one of the increased investment in infrastructure and rolling stock, making the quality and quantity of rail travel so much more inviting and pleasurable, while at the same time taking cars and lorries off the roads in the achievable pursuit of net zero targets. We could even go as far as envisaging rail as being the mainstay of an environmentally progressive system of free public transport, as the Scottish Socialist Party has argued for since 2007. Such schemes exist in Belgium, Estonia and Luxembourg. That article was by Professor Gregor Gall. Gregor Gall is Visiting Professor of Industrial Relations at the University of Leeds. This is from The National, on Monday, 30th October 2023, from the News section. UK Government announces 27 new North Sea oil and gas licences. By Ross Hunter. The UK Government has announced 27 new licence offers for oil and gas exploration in the North Sea. In what is set to be only the first round of new licences, priority has been given to sites which have the potential to go into production within a shorter time frame. The sites are largely in the central and northern North Sea and west of Shetland area. It is the 33rd round of oil and gas licensing in the UK. A total of 931 blocks and part blocks were made available for application on October 7th, 2022. The North Sea Transition Authority, or NSTA, received 115 applications from 76 companies for 258 blocks and part blocks before the close of applications on January 12, 2023. The UK government said the move is part of efforts to improve energy security in the UK, which include granting new licences and engaging with industry to scope out opportunities to reopen closed wells. However, environmental campaigners, researchers and MPs have questioned whether more domestic production will impact energy bills. Earlier this year, the NSTA granted the go-ahead for the large Rosebank oil field in the North Sea to be deployed. But the boss of Norwegian state-run energy company Equinor, who own the Rosebank site, made clear that the oil produced, there is no guarantee of being sold to UK customers. The oil goes to international markets, he said. It will be offloaded from the field. We currently can't say where it will go. If the UK needs the Rosebank oil, it will actually get it. That is pertaining to the open global market system, which today ensures the UK receives much more oil and gas than it is producing on the UKCS, UK Continental Shelf side. Still, Scotland Office Minister John Lamont welcomed the announcement of new licences. He said, "These new licences will help ensure the UK's energy security, which we have all seen as more important than ever, and reduce our need for imported energy. The UK government is committed to net zero by 2050, and oil and gas will remain an important part of our energy mix on this journey. Today's announcement will also help to support thousands of skilled jobs in Scotland, unleash further opportunities for green technologies and grow our economy." Lawyers from the environmental campaign groups Greenpeace and Uplift lost a High Court challenge over the plans to issue new licences earlier this month. There are currently 284 offshore fields in production in the UK North Sea, but environmentalists say reliance on fossil fuels for energy needs must end in order to limit damage from climate change. Scottish Greens MSP Mark Ruskell said the UK was showing disregard for future generations. He told The National, "It's an environmental disaster. Every one of these reckless new licences is a further step towards climate breakdown. The UK government is showing total disregard for future generations. In the last few months alone, we have seen record temperatures and wildfires across Europe and terrible floods in communities across Scotland. There is no sustainable future in endless oil and gas drilling. We urgently need to reduce our dependence on fossil fuels and make an urgent and lasting investment in the green jobs and industries which are so vital to tackling the climate crisis. These decisions will have an impact that endures long after the Tories have finally left Downing Street. This is a time for real and urgent climate change, not doubling down on the policies that are already causing so much irreversible damage." But Claire Coutinho, the UK's Energy Security Secretary, said granting more licences to fossil fuel companies was common sense, despite the carbon emissions they will create. "As recognised by the Independent Climate Change Committee, we'll continue to need oil and gas over the coming decades as we deliver net zero," she said. "It's common sense to reduce our reliance on foreign imports and use our own supply. It's better for our economy, the environment, and our energy security." These new licences are a welcome boost for the UK industry, which already supports around 200,000 jobs and contributes £16 billion to the economy each year, while advancing our transition to low-carbon technologies on which our future prosperity depends. That article was by Ross Hunter.
From The National, Monday the 30th of October, from the comments section, opinion, AI misinformation to be reduced by trusted journalism, by Owen Meredith, News Media Association. At the inaugural AI Safety Summit hosted by the UK at Bletchley Park this week, global leaders will be tasked with considering the risks posed by this rapidly advancing technology and how nation states act together to address challenges that cross national borders. In doing so, we can also celebrate the huge technological advances that have enabled the development of AI, presenting us all with enormous opportunities. The power of AI technology to accelerate the production and dissemination of mis- and disinformation is not on the summit's formal agenda. But with national elections happening in the UK, US and Europe next year, this threat to democracy is real. More than ever, we need trusted sources of information such as news brands to counteract the onslaught of false information and enable us to make sense of the complex world we live in today. That's why data out later this week, which is expected to show huge audiences for local news media, is so important. People are rightly hungry for authoritative sources of news and information. We must continue to ensure that supply matches demand. Next year's general election will see 650 constituencies elect a local MP. That's 650 local battles that will determine the future of our country. 650 individual elections could be influenced by AI-generated false information. AI offers an opportunity to newsrooms by automating less important tasks. The technology can free up journalists to devote their energies to the incredible scoops and investigations for which our news sector is rightly known across the world. A free press, holding power to account and asking the awkward questions of powerful people, is a fundamental to our democracy.
AI has an opportunity to enhance or destroy this mission. As a regulatory framework is developed, it is critical that governments and regulators understand the importance of protecting our media sector from the harmful effects of this technology. AI cannot be allowed to use news publishers' content in any way without their express consent. This means developing robust tools enabling publishers to fully protect their IP, the fuel that powers their businesses and enables them to invest further in journalism, from being exploited by third parties. Otherwise, the exploitation of UK content creators by powerful tech companies will accelerate dramatically, causing untold damage to our creative economy. Legislation is making its way through Parliament to address the overwhelming dominance of such of the tech platforms. The Digital Markets, Competition and Consumers Bill will give a new regulator, the Digital Markets Unit, the legal powers it needs to reset the balance, unlocking the full potential of the UK digital marketplace and massively benefiting consumers along the way. It is vital for the success of the new regime that nothing is done to weaken the bill as it passes through Parliament. The Judicial Review Appeal Standard, which has been carefully calibrated to make the regime as effective as possible, must be maintained. This week, the industry comes together for the annual Journalism Matters campaign to celebrate the vital importance of trusted news and information to our society. In an increasingly uncertain and unstable world, the need for trusted sources of information has never been greater. Whether local or national, news media plays a critical role in keeping communities informed and campaigning on issues that affect people's day-to-day lives. The industry has had a tough time in recent years, but it has continued to innovate and deliver value and trusted news and information for readers. Readers are at the heart of every newspaper, with journalists doing detailed and diligent work to analyse every story to expose the truth and present the facts to our audiences. To continue that work, it is imperative that the government upholds its commitment to repealing Section 40 of the Criminal Courts Act 2013, a commitment made in the Conservative manifestos in 2017 and 2019. The NME has welcomed provisions in the Media Bill, which we hope will be confirmed in the King's Speech next week, to repeal this pernicious piece of legislation. The bill enjoys cross-party support and should be progressed quickly. There is much to be positive about for our industry, which continues to perform its vital role in scrutinising authority and holding power to account. More than ever, we will need journalists to continue to do this on our behalf in difficult and uncertain times. As we celebrate Journalism Matters Week, I hope that you will join me in celebrating the immense value that journalism continues to deliver for our democratic society. And that was a comment, please, by News Media Association Chief Executive, Owen Meredith.
From the National, on Tuesday, the 31st of October, 2023. From the Politics section. COVID inquiry. Dominic Cummings confronted over misogynistic texts. This article was written by Hamish Morrison. Dominic Cummings has denied being a misogynist after he was confronted over a text he sent about a female colleague saying he wanted to handcuff her and escort her out of Downing Street. Boris Johnson's former top advisor was taken to task over texts he sent during the pandemic, and was asked whether he had contributed to a toxic culture at the heart of power. The COVID-19 inquiry on Tuesday was shown disparaging Dominic Cummings' texts about then-Deputy Cabinet Secretary Helen McNamara in 2020, in which he said he would handcuff her and escort her from Downing Street. Cummings wrote, "If I have to come back to Helen's bullshit from propriety and ethics team, designed to waste huge amounts of my time so I can spend it on other stuff, I will personally handcuff her and escort her from the building. I don't care how it's done, but that woman must be out of hair. We cannot keep dealing with this horrific meltdown of the British state while dodging stilettos from that C expletive." In another message shown to the inquiry, Cummings said she had been removed from her post and instead tasked with building millions of lovely houses. Counsel to the inquiry, Hugo Keith, KC, asked Cummings that he denigrated women and denigrated Helen McNamara by sending her a misogynistic message. Cummings responded, "No, that's not correct. I was not misogynistic. I was much ruder about men than I was about Helen. I agree that my language is deplorable, but as you see for yourself, I deployed the same or worse language for the Prime Minister, Secretary of State, or other people. If you want to look at how we actually ran things, unlike Whitehall, I had two young women as my deputies. I hired young women into the data science team. In the Vote Leave campaign, I actually put a woman in her 30s in charge of it, much to the rage of a lot of MPs. So if you look at the reality of how I can actually ran teams and how they got on with the private secretaries in number 10, you will see the truth of the matter." He said the outbursts about McNamara were in response to Johnson's failure to sack her despite his intentions to do so, which Cummings said had caused tension in Downing Street. He added, "Now, my language about Helen, the language is absolutely appalling, and actually I got on well with Helen at a personal level, but a thousand times worse than my bad language is the underlying issue at stake, that we had a cabinet office system that had completely melted, and the Prime Minister had half begun the process of changing the senior management and then stopped." Elsewhere, Cummings painted a picture of chaos at the heart of the government in the early days of the pandemic. He revealed that on the week beginning March 9th, 2020, he heard colleagues having phone calls about whether councils could use ice rinks as temporary morgues, as he realised he was living through a historic catastrophe. He said, "In the week beginning the 9th, I had a growing doubts on an hourly basis. By the 11th, my view was, I've got an appalling feeling that I'm in one of those historic catastrophes, like July 1914. I've got a lot of smart people coming to me saying, A, that fundamentally the strategy is wrong, misconceived, but also at a practical level. At this point, I remember I was sitting in an office and suddenly overhearing people having phone calls about whether local authorities could book out ice rinks and get people to carry massive numbers of bodies and store them in ice rinks. These conversations suddenly exploded in the week of the 9th. So, on the other hand, a fundamental argument is the strategy misconceived or not, but we also had this sort of growing cascade of nightmare conversations going on around us, where we realised that the system was just completely out of control in terms of coping with its original plan A." That article was written by Hamish Morrison. From The National, on Tuesday, the 31st of October, 2023. From the Politics section. Scottish school staff set to strike again in ongoing pay dispute. This article was written by Laura Pollock. Union members are readying themselves for a further wake of school strike action in Scotland's schools and early years centres this week in a continuing dispute with councils over pay. School support staff in East Renfrewshire, Glasgow, Inverclyde and Renfrewshire, including janitors and crossing patrollers, are preparing to hold a one-day strike on Wednesday, meaning hundreds of schools may have to close. The demonstration is part of rolling strike action scheduled to take place across the country in the coming weeks after Unison rejected a pay offer from the Convention of Scottish Local Authorities, COSLA. The revised offer represents a minimum increase of £2,006 for workers on the Scottish Local Government Living Wage and a minimum of £1,929 for those above the rate. The living wage of £10.85 will rise to £11.89 per hour, equivalent to a 9.6 increase. Joanna Baxter, Unison's Scotland's head of local government, said, "The last thing we want is to cause disruption for pupils and parents, but school staff have been left with no other option. Workers are taking action because they want children to be educated in well-resourced, well-staffed schools. and they want to start trying to reserve the years of underinvestment in both the workforce and services. While no deal has yet been reached, we continue to have constructive dialogue with Cosla, and we remain committed to resolving this dispute as soon as possible. Mark Ferguson, chair of Unison's local government committee, said, "Our members voted overwhelmingly to reject Cosla's pay offer and are determined to fight for the improved pay offer they deserve. Cosla and the Scottish Government need to give school staff a decent wage rise, fund any increase properly, and commit to implementing a minimum underpinning rate of pay of £15 per hour for all local government workers." Kate Hagman, Cosla's resources spokesperson, previously said it had put an incredibly strong £500 million pay package on the table, and that the results of Unison's strike ballot was disappointing. Offering almost 10%, or a £2,006 pay increase for lowest paid workers, which the union asked for, and £1,929, or at least a 5.5% for everyone else, is as far as local government can go without impacting services and jobs, she said. That article was written by Laura Pollock.
The National World News on Wednesday, the 1st of November. Aid agency says 64 staff have been killed since the war began. An article written by George Gaynor. A United Nations relief agency for Palestinians has said 64 of its staff have been killed since the start of the war, including a man killed alongside his wife and 8 children in a strike late on Monday. Spokesperson Juliette Tuma said, "This is the highest number ever of UN aid workers killed in any conflict around the world in such a short time. The United Nations Relief and Works Agency will never be the same without these colleagues." Hundreds of thousands of people in Gaza rely on the agency for basic services, even in normal times. The agency's head, Philippe Lazzarini, accused Israel of a collective punishment of the Palestinians and of forcing their displacement from northern Gaza to the south, where they are still not safe. Meanwhile, United Nations Secretary-General Antonio Guterres last night released a statement saying he is deeply alarmed by the intensification of the conflict in Gaza, adding, "This includes the expansion of ground operations by the Israel Defense Forces, accompanied by intense airstrikes and the continued rocket fire towards Israel from Gaza." He went on to reiterate his call for a ceasefire for unimpeded humanitarian access. Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant said the military was deploying forces on a large scale in the depths of Gaza. Referring to the deaths of 2 soldiers, he said, "Achievements on the battlefield have been very high. Unfortunately, in war, there's also a price, and in the last day, the price has been high." Israeli forces have reportedly advanced north and east of Gaza City. South of the city, Israeli troops were also trying to cut off the territory's main highway and the parallel road along the Mediterranean coast, according to Dawood Shahab, a spokesperson for Islamic Jihad, a smaller militant group allied with Hamas. The Israeli military said it struck some 300 militant targets over the past day, including compounds inside tunnels, and that troops had engaged in several battles with militants armed with anti-tank missiles and machine guns. It released video footage showing soldiers and a tank moving down a dirt road between 2 rows of demolished buildings, some of which had been 3 to 4 stories high. Hamas released its own video showing what it said was a battle in northern Gaza on Sunday. In it, a fighter wearing a GoPro-style camera emerged from a tunnel with a rocket-propelled grenade launcher and ran across sand dunes and shrubs with other militants amid gunfire. Hamas's military wing also said it fired mortar rounds at Israeli forces near a closed border crossing in the southern end of the territory. It was not possible to independently confirm reports by either side. The World Health Organization said 2 hospitals have been damaged and an ambulance destroyed in Gaza over the past 2 days. It said all 13 hospitals in the north have received Israeli evacuation orders. Medics have refused to heed such orders, saying it would be a death sentence to move patients on life support. Gaza City's Shifa Hospital, the Strip's largest, is on the verge of running out of fuel, the health ministry said. There has been no central electricity in Gaza for weeks, and Israel has barred the entry of fuel for generators, saying it wants to prevent it from falling into Hamas's hands. It has allowed a limited amount of food, water, medicine and other supplies to enter from Egypt, far less than what is needed, relief groups say. A convoy of 59 trucks entered via the Rafah crossing with Egypt yesterday. Before the conflict, about 500 trucks a day were crossing into Gaza. More than half the Strip's 2.3 million population have fled their homes, with hundreds of thousands sheltering in packed UN-run schools or in hospitals alongside thousands of wounded patients. Jonathan Conricus, an Israeli military spokesperson, said ground operations are focused in northern Gaza, including Gaza City, which he said was the centre of gravity of Hamas. But we also continue to strike in other parts of Gaza. We're hunting their commanders, we're attacking their infrastructure, and whenever there is an important target that is related to Hamas, we strike it, he said. Mr. Conricus said about 800,000 people have heeded Israel's orders to flee to the south, but tens of thousands of people remain in and around Gaza City, and casualties are expected to rise on both sides as the battle moves into residential neighbourhoods. An article written by George Gaynor. The National, on Wednesday, the 1st of November. Opinion. Scotland needs the power to solve energy issues now. A column written by Alan Smith. It's often said that the more things change, the more they stay the same. Such is often the case with Westminster. The SNP has repeatedly warned about the UK's broken energy market. We have repeatedly noted that people living in Scotland pay the highest energy prices compared to the rest of the UK, despite the country producing the most energy. And the UK government repeatedly sticks its head in the sand as if nothing can be done about this. Spoiler alert, it can. As we head towards the winter, many families across my constituency of Stirling and Scotland are worried about how much their energy costs are going to rise. Many reluctantly put on their heating as the nights draw in. For others, the choice is between heating and eating. And all this whilst the UK is supposedly one of the richest countries in the world. I fear that worse is to come. Russia's renewed invasion against Ukraine since February 2022 led to skyrocketing prices for oil and gas, a reminder of the folly of placing energy security in the hands of an authoritarian regime. As we all now look on with horror at the events unfolding in Israel and the occupied Palestinian territories, there's a further reminder that in today's globalised world, we are all interconnected and interdependent. The situation continues to evolve on an hourly, never mind daily basis, yet it is certain that energy costs will rise because of events in the region. It was rather alarming then to read in the Financial Times earlier this week that the World Bank believes that in a worst-case scenario, global oil supply could shrink by 6 million to 8 million barrels a day, sending prices to between $140 and $157 a barrel. The report added that even in small or medium disruption scenarios, oil prices could hit $102 to $121 a barrel. That is only oil. Given the Middle East also produces a significant amount of the world's natural gas, it's reasonable to see similar increases in prices for this commodity too. This all reiterates the point that we need to transition away from fossil fuels to renewable energy sources. Progress has been made in moving towards cleaner forms of energy, yet it's also the case that the world consumes more energy than ever before, with current oil demand alone standing at 102 million barrels per day. Replacing oil with greener energy requires political will to create the market demand. Solar panels can be installed on rooftops, wind turbines on hills, and tidal generators in the sea. These are all better options than burning more fossil fuels on an overheated planet with an increasing number of extreme weather patterns. However, there is an immediate crisis for households up and down the country, and there are proactive steps the UK government could take now to help households meet the cost of energy. It could reintroduce the £400 energy rebate that was implemented last winter. It could reform the grid charging system to incentivise investment where it would be best placed for maximum efficiency, thereby bringing down costs for all of us. And it could match the Scottish Government's Scottish Child Payment, which would help free up funds for families with children. Will we see any movement on this issue from the UK Government in next week's King's Speech? I highly doubt it, which is why we need the powers over energy given to the Scottish Parliament in the short term so that we can deliver solutions which meet the needs of the people of Scotland. It's ultimately, though, another reason why independence in Europe is so badly needed. The UK's energy market is broken, and despite an ongoing cost of living crisis, the UK government shows no incentive or inclination to enact the reforms that are needed. Countries around the world are suffering from inflation and cost of living pressures, but it's only in Scotland that Westminster's inactivity is making a bad situation much worse. With the powers of independence, we can prioritise investment in energy-efficient homes and infrastructure. We can further incentivise indigenous development of renewable and green hydrogen energy companies. Energy can be utilised as a public good, not merely a tool for private profit. We need energy powers devolved to Holyrood to help households immediately. We need independence to help our communities prosper indefinitely. A column written by Alan Smith. The National News on Wednesday, the 1st of November. Scams warning over cost of living payment. An article written by James Walker. Scots have been urged to be alert to the risk of scams as cost of living payments of £300 start arriving in bank accounts. Almost 700,000 households in Scotland will automatically receive the money, which is part of a Department for Work and Pensions package for those who are on means-tested benefits. It's due to arrive in bank accounts from yesterday until November the 19th. It's the second of three instalments that will eventually total £900. The payments are made directly into recipients' bank accounts with no need to apply or do anything, meaning people should not respond to scam texts or emails asking to fill out application forms. Advice Direct Scotland, which runs the National Consumer Advice.Scot service, urged people to report any suspected scams to its ScamWatch service, with the organisation able to then share this information with the authorities. The service is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. Specialist debt advisers will work with anyone in Scotland who has money problems to assess their current situation, look at their income and outgoings, and consider what to do next. Connor Forbes, Director of Policy with Advice Direct Scotland, said, "Hundreds of thousands of Scots households will start receiving the cost of living support payment, and it's vital to remember that this will happen automatically. Sadly, we know that scammers have repeatedly tried to capitalise on the cost of living crisis, so people should be alert to emails and texts asking for personal information in relation to the payments. The Department of Work and Pensions will not do this. If you suspect a scam, use our free ScamWatch tool at www.consumeradvice.scot. Moreover, for those concerned about their financial commitments, our specialist debt advisers can assess your situation and provide guidance on managing your income and expenses. You can reach out to Advice Direct Scotland's moneyadvice.scot service at 0808 196 2316. 0808 196 2316 for free information and support on various debt-related issues. An article written by James Walker.
From The National, Wednesday the 1st of November, from the Culture section, Four Scottish castles featured on list of best in the UK. Article by Adam Robertson. Four Scottish castles have been named as being among the top 10 in the UK in a list compiled by South Western Railway, SWR. In order to discover the UK's top castle getaways, SWR collated a list of 79 UK castle hotels and then generated a score based on TripAdvisor ratings. 19th century Phonab Castle in Perthshire is ranked second in the UK behind Pentheal Castle Castle Estate in Devon. The other castles in Scotland included Fasside Estate in Musselburgh, which was ranked in third place. Kilmartin Castle in Argyll was ranked seventh. Meanwhile, where Balcaldin Castle, also located in Argyll, came in eighth place. On Phonab, SWR said, "The remarkable Phonab Castle is a listed mansion built in 1892, hidden amongst an 11-acre estate. With an almost perfect 4.5 out of 5 TripAdvisor score and almost 4,000 reviews, visitors have clearly been blown away by Phonab Castle." On Fasside Estate, it said, "Fasside's origins go back as far as 1189 and feature a rich and bloody history. It was set alight by the English before the Battle of Pinkie Cleugh and hosted Mary, Queen of Scots, on the eve of the Carbery Hill Battle." And that was from the Culture section by Adam Robertson. From the National, Thursday the 2nd of November, from the Politics section, Anna Sarwar said, "Keir Starmer's Gaza comments lacked humanity." Article by Adam Robertson. Scottish Labour leader Anna Sarwar said that Keir Starmer's comments on Gaza lacked empathy and humanity, according to a report. Sarwar outlined his frustration during a meeting with a pro-Labour Muslim group over Starmer's backing for Israel cutting off humanitarian supplies to Gaza. According to a leaked account of a meeting with MSPs and the Labour Muslim Network, obtained by the Daily Record, Sarwar also said that a peer job with Muslim voters would be required every day until the next Westminster election. Specifically, Sarwar was upset with Starmer over an LBC radio interview on October 11th, in which he suggested Israel had the right to withhold water and supplies from Gaza. The Labour leader was later forced to clarify his comments, saying he meant that Israel has the right to self-defence, rather than saying that Israel had the right to cut off water, food, fuel or medicines. Sarwar's meeting with the Labour Muslim Network came on October 16th. He said, "I recognise what you say around the heart, particularly felt by Muslim communities. If anything, I would say you downplayed the hurt rather than played it up. I can tell you firsthand how devastated people are right across the Muslim community. And that is not to negate or talk down the devastation felt in the Jewish community." He continued, "That humanity and empathy is, if we're being blunt about it, what has been missing from some of the statements which has caused so much of the hurt, where it feels as if there is an inconsistency or a dehumanising, or not seeing the value of one life being equal to another life." The Scottish Labour leader also said Starmer's common statement earlier that day had been a lot better, but that, ideally, it should have been a lot sooner. He said that empathy had to be included in every single statement that was made from every single Labour voice. That empathy, which includes statements like "every life is equal," "every Palestinian life is equal to every Israeli life," "one life lost in Palestine, one life lost in Israel is one life too many," and "I think that the level of humanity has been the bit that has been missing," Sarwar added. "I made the point to senior colleagues, you can work out who they are, saying it shouldn't take a Muslim voice in Scotland to be getting people to understand the impact on Asian communities across the country of what language is being said, but, sadly, that's what it's been, or that's what it felt like." We have got to hope that Starmer's statement today acts as a basis for the future direction. I think we have got to be cautious about that, though, because I think we have got to keep pressing. Sarwar said it is at odds with Starmer over Gaza, with the Scottish Labour leader having called for a ceasefire, a position Starmer has thus far refused to adopt. Rutherglen and Hamilton West MP Michael Shanks has also backed Starmer's stance. Elsewhere, Shadow Foreign Secretary D. David Lammy, has faced heavy criticism for claiming an Israeli airstrike in a refugee camp could be legally justified. A Scottish Labour spokesperson said, "We do not comment on leaks from private meetings." Labour is united in calling for an end of violence, the protection of civilians, the release of hostages and the delivery of vital humanitarian aid. We continue to support a two-state solution with a free, secure and sovereign Israel alongside a free, secure and sovereign Palestine. This decades-long conflict is not about the Labour Party and should not be trivialised by trying to make it about that. And that article was by Adam Robertson. From the National, Thursday the 2nd of November, from the news section. Storm Ciarán, Scotland. Warning people could face travel disruption. Article by Adam Robertson. Train passengers travelling between Scotland and England will face disruption on Thursday due to weather warnings in place as a result of Storm Ciarán. A yellow warning for rain is in place for eastern Scotland until 6 a.m. on Saturday. Train operators have warned travellers to expect disruption in cross-border services, and no LNER services will operate between Edinburgh and Aberdeen after 10:30 a.m. on Thursday until Saturday. The operator services between Newcastle and Edinburgh will run on an hourly service from 3 p.m. and will be in place until the end of service on Friday. Speed restrictions will be in place on the route, which may see services subject to delays of up to 40 minutes. Network Rail is also imposing speed restrictions across parts of Scotland and, while most ScotRail services will be unaffected, some areas will see delays. Speed restrictions will be in place on routes between Aberdeen and Inverness, Berwick and Edinburgh, Edinburgh and Dundee, Dundee and Aberdeen. TransPennine Express services between Newcastle and Edinburgh will also be subject to delays. Meanwhile, the Scottish Environment Protection Agency has issued a number of flood alerts across parts of Scotland. They are in place in Aberdeenshire and Aberdeen City, Dumfries and Galloway, Dundee and Angus, Edinburgh and Lothians, Fife, Findhorn, Nairn, Moray and Speyside, Scottish Borders, Tayside. And the article was by Adam Robertson. From the National, Thursday the 2nd of November, from the news section, Tory council rages at being left unable to sack employees to save cash. Article by Ross Hunter. A Tory-run council has expressed disappointment at being left unable to sack council employees in order to save money. Councillors in Moray voted to adopt a no-compulsory redundancies policy put forward by the SNP late last month. It means that Moray Council cannot terminate the contract of employees due to business circumstances. Supporters of the policy say it provides job security to council workers during perilous financial times. However, all Conservative councillors voted against the policy. Regardless, it was approved by 13 votes to 12. In a statement released on Wednesday, the Moray Conservatives group fumed at being left unable to sack council workers to cut costs. "We are extremely concerned that irresponsible no-compulsory redundancy policy put forward by the SNP will hinder efforts to create a more sustainable Moray Council, as it takes away the option to make services more financially efficient through restructuring," it read. "This is pure politicking from the SNP at a time the council needs every option available to us. Between this and the council tax freeze they did not consult councils on, the SNP have obstructed our efforts to transform Moray Council. Of course, we recognise the value of our staff and are grateful to them for all their hard work. The existing policy was that compulsory redundancy was a last resort. But, with millions of pounds to find thanks to continuous underfunding from the SNP Scottish Government, savings must be found somewhere and this now makes it even more difficult to do so." Leader of the Moray Liberal Democrats, Neil Alexander, called for councillors who do not believe they're up to the job of managing the council to resign. "I'm in shock at the anger from the Conservative administration," he said. "Just because they've been told they can't sack council employees without good reason. We should be protecting families during the cost of living crisis, not taking away their jobs.
What is clear from their statement is that they do not believe themselves that they are up to the job of running Moray Council. They are the ones who should be facing a compulsory redundancy. It is their own party that has caused the cost of living crisis we are facing. If they do not think they can run a council because of this, they should all resign and let in people that actually want to help the people of Moray through the cost of living crisis. Meanwhile, SNP councillor Jeremy Fernandez, who initially proposed the policy back in June, said the Tories' reaction suggests they view employees as expendable. Moray Council is one of the biggest employers in the region, so ensuring workers' job safety is crucial to the local economy, he said. This policy means 5,000 employees and their families will not have to worry about being made redundant in the middle of a cost of living crisis. It's a shame that Tory councillors see employees, particularly those in a lower salary or a part-time contract, as expendable. In a bizarre outburst, Tory councillor and deputy council leader Donald Gatt said the decision to prevent compulsory redundancies is akin to the railways after converting from steam engines to diesel and electric, still employing firemen. And that article was written by Ross Hunter.
This is from The National on Thursday, 2nd November 2023. From the Culture section. Major airline acts as popular route from Scottish airport to Norway. By Adam Robertson. A major airline has withdrawn a popular flight route between a Scottish airport and a capital city. The Herald reports that Scandinavian Airlines has said it has withdrawn its Edinburgh to Oslo service until its resource situation is more clear. The newspaper reports the route was withdrawn amid wider financial considerations rather than individual commercial success. However, the airline has said it remains committed to the Scottish capital, with Sweden and Denmark routes continuing, and it may reintroduce the summer route to Oslo, the Norwegian capital. A spokesperson for SAS told the Herald, "It's correct that we've pulled Edinburgh to Oslo for sale at this stage. We remain committed to the Edinburgh market, though, and may well add back the Oslo route once our resource situation is more clear. We continue to serve Edinburgh from both Stockholm with daily service from April onwards and Copenhagen with summer seasonal service." SAS previously reported that 2.3 million passengers travelled with the airline in September, a 17% increase compared with the same month last year. Edinburgh Airport declined to comment further. Last week it was reported that Edinburgh had welcomed the launch of JetBlue's first Scottish route to New York. That article was by Adam Robertson.
That concludes this week's edition of the National Podcast. Please remember to subscribe to our channels at Pune Review and tell your friends about our service.